Monitor Monday is recorded before a live online audience. From the studios of RAC Monitor, this is Monitor Monday for October 30th, 2023. Here's today's rundown. Last week's deadly mass shootings in Maine reminds us that violence in America's hospitals is a growing issue for administrators and staff. Reporting our lead story this morning is senior healthcare consultant Dennis Jones. We will also hear from healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel, Kate Brantley, healthcare attorney David Glazer, and Dr. Ronald Hirsch. Now here's the publisher of RAC Monitor and the host of Monitor Monday, Chuck Buck.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Monitor Monday. We have a great deal of healthcare news reports, so we begin this morning, as we usually do, with Dr. Ronald Hirsch. He is making his Monday Rounds here on Monitor Monday.
Monday Rounds is sponsored by R1 Physician Advisory Solutions. Here now making his Monday Rounds is Dr. Ronald Hirsch.
Well, good morning, all. Today is another segment with a bunch of quick updates. First up, 2 weeks ago, CMS announced that they have withdrawn the national coverage determination for amyloid PET scans used to diagnose and monitor the response to treatment in Alzheimer's disease. The NCD did allow one PET scan for patients who are participating in clinical trials, which became a problem when CMS approved payment for Leqembi outside of clinical trials. Patients needed a PET scan to see if the drug was right for them, but could not get Medicare to pay for it. Now, having the NCD completely withdrawn is both good news and bad news. The good news, of course, is that there's no specific requirements from CMS to obtain one. But the bad news is it leaves coverage determinations to the discretion of the Medicare administrative contractors. Will the MACs place specific requirements on coverage? Will each MAC come up with their own requirements, creating a patchwork of coverage depending on the state where the patient resides? If you're performing these scans now, I would just ensure that the documentation clearly supports performing the scan and that it's in the hospital medical record. Next, the American College of Rheumatology and American Academy of Hip and Knee Surgeons recently met and developed clinical guidelines related to the timing of elective joint replacement surgery. And their conclusion was that the timing should be a shared decision between the patient and the surgeon, and there's no role for specific timeframes for trials of conservative therapy. Now, several MACs have LCDs specifying a 3-month trial of conservative care. What will happen with this? Well, don't know, but I formally asked 2 MACs to revise their LCDs. Will they? Time will tell. Now, last week, I also talked about discharge planning and CMS's statement that your choice list does not need to include providers that do not have open beds. Well, this week, I can report another change. If you read the Federal Register from 2019, it states, hospitals must not develop preferred lists of providers. That's pretty definitive. But Alicia Tenenbaum from Mount Sinai in New York sent me a copy of a notice where CMS states that the term preferred provider can be used to label post-acute providers on the list provided to patients as long as the list includes other facilities that can provide the needed care and the list includes quality and resource use data for every facility, including the preferred providers. Now, when I read this, it made me a little nervous, but perhaps all CMS was saying back in 2019 was that they don't want hospitals to only offer patients the choice list that has only preferred facilities on it. Finally, Levanta's newsletter had a story of a patient who was hospitalized with a stroke and then sent home with home care. The daughter called Levanta because after a week, no one had shown up and her calls were not answered. Levanta contacted the hospital and the case manager contacted the home care agency, and the agency told the case manager they declined the patient due to understaffing. What happened here? Who messed this one up? I can't believe a hospital would refer a patient to a home care agency and not confirm that the patient was accepted. And I can't believe that a home care agency would accept a patient and then decline the patient without notifying the hospital. Just doesn't make any sense. But whatever happened here, I do know that the hospital has to recode the claim since home care did not begin within 3 days of discharge. Back to you, Chuck.
Thank you, Dr. Hirsch. That was the Vice President of R1 RCM, Ronald Hirsch, MD. Dr. Hirsch is making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday. Here now with the Monitor Monday RAC Report is healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. Good morning, Nicole.
Hello, and happy RAC Monitor Monday. Happy Halloween tomorrow. For Monitor Monday, I'm dressed up as a RAC auditor. I get a spooky 13.5% commission for overzealous auditing tactics. RAC auditors come in every shape, size, color, or gender. In my experience, RACs are garishly incorrect in their assessments, and I will reveal three real-life examples where these contractors accused healthcare providers of owing money but were found to be dead wrong. The example one, medical necessity quibbles. In a haunting case involving a hospital, the RAC alleged that certain cardiac procedures were billed inappropriately, citing concerns about the medical necessity of these services. They claimed the hospital should refund a repugnant amount for these procedures. However, upon closer examination and an appeal process, it was revealed that the services were indeed medically necessary and aligned with standard protocols. The ghastly RAC's accusation was disproven, and the hospital was not required to return any funds. Spine tingling. Example two, improper coding of diagnoses. A healthcare provider, particular in this case, it was a large physician group, was accused by a RAC of using suspicious, improper diagnostic codes, leading to overbilling for certain services provided to Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries. After a thorough internal audit, it was determined that the codes used were accurate and supported by the patient's medical records. The RAC's allegations were unfounded and no payment was required. Suspicious, a haunting reminder to spook audits. Example three is an alleged duplicate billing. In a murderous case involving a nursing facility, the RAC identified what they believed were instances of duplicate billing for certain procedures and services. Upon further review, it was revealed that the billing discrepancies were due to the RAC's misunderstanding of the facility's billing processes. Mysterious. The facility provided evidence showcasing that the billed services were distinct and not duplicates. Consequently, the RAC's claim was refuted and no repayment was deemed necessary. But it's suspicious. These examples underscore the critical need for providers to have robust internal compliance measures in place. While RACs serve a vital purpose in identifying billing errors, they are not infallible. Providers need to be equipped to challenge these audit findings, ensuring they are based on accurate and comprehensive information. It's crucial for healthcare providers to engage in proactive approach by conducting their internal audits, maintaining accurate documentation, and being prepared to challenge RAC determinations when necessary. These efforts not only protect providers from unwarranted financial obligations, but also ensure that Medicare and Medicaid funds are properly allocated. The relationship between RACs and healthcare providers and government healthcare programs is complex. The examples that I just gave demonstrate that while RACs do play a critical role in safeguarding the integrity of the funds, their findings are not always accurate. Providers must be diligent in ensuring their billing practices align with regulations and be prepared to contest any erroneous audit findings to maintain fiscal stability and fair reimbursement for services rendered. Boo, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Nicole, very much. That was healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. Nicole is a partner in the law firm of Nelson Mullins. And coming up at about, 10 minutes after the hour in your time zone, you're going to hear from healthcare attorney David Glazer, Kate Brantley, and Dennis Jones. He's standing by to report our lead story. Folks, it is Monday. It's October the 30th, and you'll listen to a live edition of Monitor Monday.
The American College of Physician Advisors is the only physician-led nonprofit national association of thought leaders representing all aspects of the physician advisor role. Developed to expand the influence of physician advisors
Through education and industry networking, the membership consists of physician advisors and other hospital leaders focused on a broad range of topics, including utilization management, case management, clinical documentation integrity, regulatory compliance, revenue cycle, and executive leadership. You are invited to partner with physician leaders and associated healthcare professionals and join the effort to foster greater physician executive influence within healthcare systems. Access uniquely formatted Medicare inpatient-only lists designed for ease of use, and take advantage of CME discounts available only to members. Click on the ad on the RAC Monitor homepage or go to acpadvisors.org to learn more.
Here now with the Monitor Money Risky Business Report is healthcare attorney David Glazer. And David, as I say every Monday morning about the same time, what could be risky today?
I would say it's the risk that the Halloween Stranger Danger speech will bleed into your approach to internal investigations. As an aside, the whole Stranger Danger thing never made sense to me, but that's off topic. So in non-Halloween terms, it's the risk that you'll overvalue the benefits of a personal connection when you're conducting compliance interviews. So internal investigations are a key part of the compliance process. And the ability to have an effective interview will often determine whether your investigation properly identifies all of the issues. And I want to challenge a notion that's quite common. In fact, it's a position that I held for some time before witnessing a situation that caused me to flip. It's easy to assume that having an interview conducted by someone the interviewee trusts and knows well will yield the most effective results. And I will concede that there are times where that's probably true, but more often, I think that as long as the interviewer is amiable and skilled, an outsider can be more effective. Here's the story that changed my mind. I was representing a skilled nursing facility that was talking to its employees to get to the bottom of some False Claims Act allegations. The nursing facility's general counsel, let's call her Chris, was observing the interviews with me. She felt like she had a good relationship with her staff and that people would be more likely to talk if she was present. I deferred to her. First, my client is the boss. I make recommendations, but I serve at their pleasure. And her position didn't seem crazy to me. Wow, were we wrong. During our very first interview with an employee who both knew and liked the general counsel, Chris stepped out to take a call. Within seconds after she left, the witness interrupted a question to say, "Hey, there's one thing I want to talk about before Chris comes back." So began my lesson into the advantages of being an outsider. The witness wanted to describe a concern she had about some of the actions within the corporation, but she was worried about Chris's reaction. The employee worried that the information may reflect badly on Chris, and therefore sharing it could cause Chris to view the employee negatively. In essence, the employee thought sharing the relationship may hurt her relationship with the general counsel. The more I considered it, the more I realized that outsiders often a material advantage when it comes to interviews. If you're looking for brutal honesty, do you go to the neighborhood barbecue or to the internet? By no means am I suggesting that reading the comments on the internet articles is the way to go, but it's important to recognize that the anonymity of the internet often leads to increased candor. Now, I live in Minnesota, and while some people misunderstand Minnesota nice to be a form of kindness, it's really passive aggression. Many people will be hesitant to be completely honest with someone in the organization. That will be particularly true if the person is embarrassed by what they have to say or worried that a more senior person will hold it against them. I do believe that there are situations where close relationships matter. I've talked about the benefit of compliance professionals buying coffee for staff to get a strong relationship. I'm starting to see a divide between situations where you're trying to reassure an employee that the organization has their back and internal investigations. My current thinking is that assurances should come from insiders, and investigation is often best done by outsiders. One final quick point. One of the strikes against external investigation is cost. And it's true, it can cost a bit more to have an outsider do the investigation. But if you're thinking that one of those costs is travel, I will note that even before the pandemic, I did many interviews over the phone. Just as the internet can lead to heightened honesty, so, surprisingly perhaps, can a remote interview. There's something about this distance that often results in people being more open. So Chuck, the bottom line is that when you're thinking about conducting interviews, you, like Pat Benatar, might be best served looking for a stranger.
I'm tired of the same old. Hello, baby, how you doing? Come here often, where have you been? I need a little danger in my life.
She was doing it because she was tired of the same old, hello, baby, how you doing? And looking for a little danger in her life. But you should do it because it might get you a better interview. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, David, very much. That was healthcare attorney David Glazer. David is a shareholder in the law firm of Frederickson & Byron in downtown Minneapolis. Up next, Kate Bradley with the Monitor Monday Legislative Update.
The Legislative Update is sponsored by Zealous. Zealous is modernizing the healthcare financial experience by bridging the gaps and aligning interests across payers, providers, and healthcare consumers.
Here now is Kate Brantley. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Chuck. Well, I've got a couple of updates for you in the absolute roller coaster that is the No Surprises Act's Independent Dispute Resolution, or IDR, process. The federal government officially filed their formal notice of an intent to appeal the ruling of TMA's third lawsuit, conveniently called TMA 3, regarding the calculation of the qualifying payment amount, or QPA, in the IDR process. There isn't really any supporting documentation yet of what exactly their argument will be, but this is the first step in the process after CMS stated their plans to appeal and guidance released early this month that discussed the outcomes of the most recent TMA cases. This appeal is separate from the government's appeal of TMA 2 back in the spring, but will be heard in the same court, the Fifth Circuit. In that case, both sides have filed their written briefs, and a hearing will likely be scheduled next. With all this up in the air and CMS stating that they really did not intend to put out interim guidance on the subject of the TMA 3 ruling, some thought we were in a holding pattern as these appeals played out, and there are no lawsuits still pending in Texas court at this time, so we kind of sat back and waited. But very late Friday afternoon, the government issued a proposed rule making changes to the IDR process that, although it doesn't address the TMA ruling directly, still features quite a few changes that aim to address many of the criticisms the process has faced over the last few months. Take, for example, the backlog in the IDR process, which is partially a result of the unexpectedly high numbers of disputes submitted, as well as those that end up being ineligible for the entire process. Under this new proposal, an eligibility review process the government can invoke when dispute volumes are high is created, and payers would be required to include additional information in their initial payment or notice of denial of payment that would hopefully make eligibility easier to determine and, if eligible, open negotiations more meaningful. Another concern has been ease of access to the entire IDR process. Many providers have expressed concern that the process is not as accessible as it should be, whether through what they believe to be overly restrictive batching rules or the mandatory administrative fee. The newly released proposed rule appears to address some of these concerns because it broadens the batching provisions, like allowing batching of claims related to a single patient encounter, those billed under the same service code or comparable code on a different system, and for certain specialties like anesthesiology, radiology, and pathology, those items and services billed under service codes belonging to the same category CPT code section. It also proposes that the administrative fee be collected by the government directly from the disputing parties and that it be at a reduced rate in certain situations where it would be unfair to charge the full amount. According to the administration, the proposed rule is meant to, quote, improve communication between payers, providers, and certified IDR entities, create a more efficient dispute resolution process, and change the administrative fee structure to improve accessibility. In that early October guidance I mentioned, CMS stated that any proposals around the QPA methodology would require a lot of resources and take months rather than weeks. So it's not entirely unlikely that we'll be waiting for the resolution of the TMA appeals for the next big changes in guidance. With how many ups and downs the IDR process has gone through lately, though, Chuck, you never know. Back to you.
Thanks, Kate, very much. That was Kate Brantley. Kate is a state legislative analyst for Zealous.
Get ready for a spine-tingling Halloween sale. From now until the witching hour on November 1st, there's a ghoulishly good deal you won't want to miss. It's the Spooky Sale, and it's not just for one brand, but for all three brands, Medlearn Publishing, Rack Monitor, and ICD-10 Monitor. Save a chilling 31% on a treasure trove of educational resources, webinars, and more. Just use the promo code SPOOKY23 at checkout. Exclusions apply. Hurry, the Spooky Sale is a limited-time offer that's sure to give you goosebumps. Don't let it haunt your dreams. Shop now and save big. Medlearn Publishing, Rack Monitor, ICD-10 Monitor. Your Halloween season just got spooktacular.
As you heard us mention at the top of the broadcast, last week's mass killing in the state of Maine suggests that violence in our society has now encroached into the medical workplace. Today, violence in America is top of mind awareness among hospital administrators and staff. Here now to report our lead story, Violence in America's Hospitals, the senior healthcare consultant, Dennis Jones. Good morning, Dennis.
Thank you, Chuck. You referred to the tragic story in Maine last week, and words cannot express how truly sad that was. The mass killings in our country are just relentless. The violence seen in our society has increasingly encroached into the hospital workplace. This violence can be verbal, it can be physical, it can be aggressive, and it can be deadly. The escalation and the prevalence of violence in hospitals has had a major impact on employees, patients, and families. Let me just start with the update. On October 20th, the Connecticut Hospital Association issued a patient and family code of conduct, and I'll read from that document. Exceptional patient care requires a safe, supportive, inclusive, equitable, and respectful environment that involves a commitment by patients, hospital staffs, families, and visitors to maintain such an environment. Behavior that interferes with the delivery of health care or creates an unsafe and disrespectful environment is unacceptable. The code identifies aggressive behaviors, threats, abusive and discriminatory language, and sexual harassment as examples of unacceptable behavior. Further, possession of weapons of any kind will constitute a violation of this policy. Individuals violating this policy can be asked to leave the facility and may be refused non-emergency services in the future. The Connecticut Hospital Association's policy is the first of its kind to address violence against healthcare workers at all of a state's hospitals. The CHA's actions may set an example for other states. We've all read the increasing number of alarming headlines over the past few years. This past June, a nurse in neighboring Massachusetts was slashed in the throat by a patient when she leaned over to adjust the patient's oxygen tube. In August, a visitor shot and killed a hospital security guard when he was trying to escort the man out of the Portland, Oregon hospital's maternity ward. But it's not just these tragic and sensational stories that represent the full picture of violence against hospital workers. Nurses, doctors, and other hospital workers are often punched, slapped, kicked, screamed at, and threatened while on the job. These incidents are seldom reported and never make the local news. In hospital emergency departments, these incidences often occur because patients and families do not understand the concept of triaged care, where those who are most in need get treated first. People are most accustomed to a first-come, first-served process. This does not work in an emergency department, and you would think that more would understand that. I guess that for many, my emergency is the most important emergency. An emergency room nurse at UConn Health reported that she recently had a full urine bottle thrown at her by a patient because she had spent time in the adjacent care station treating a critical patient. In a suburban New York hospital where I worked, we had a father of a little girl brandish a handgun in the emergency waiting room because he felt his daughter was not being seen quickly enough. According to the CHA announcement, at least 5 healthcare workers are assaulted daily in the state's hospitals. And it is notable that, according to a recent study by the CDC, American healthcare workers now suffer more non-fatal injuries from workplace violence than workers in any other profession, including law enforcement. Not only does violence in hospitals create a dangerous environment for hospital employees and patients, in a time when nurses and doctors are feeling burnout and leaving the field for less stressful positions, the headlines and frequent incidents of violence in our hospitals are only making staffing problems worse. The announcement of the Patient and Visitor Code of Conduct by the Connecticut Hospital Association will help publicize the issue of violence in hospitals, and it may take some of the public relations pressure off of individual hospitals in the state. Everyone who works in a hospital or knows somebody who works in a hospital should welcome what is hopefully a trend-setting policy. That's it, Chuck. Thanks. Back to you.
Thanks, Dennis, very much. That was Dennis Jones, Senior Director of Revenue Cycle at Jefferson Health. And folks, that's going to be a wrap for this live edition of Monitor Monday. We thank you so very much for being with us today. And a special thank you to our panelists, Kate Brantley, Nicole Emanuel, David Glazer, Dr. Ronald Hirsch, and Dennis Jones, who reported our lead story. And folks, one more thing before we go. Please join me tomorrow on Talk Ten Tuesday. We're going to have an exclusive report on new codes and guidelines that are impacting coders and other healthcare professionals. Until then, this is Chuck Buck. Have a great week, everybody.
Monitor Monday is a presentation of Rack Monitor.